From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. History textbooks around the world tell quite different tales of what has been and what it means, and what children hear in other countries, what they're learning about American history, will surprise you. Tonight on Point, Learning American History Abroad, what kids from Beijing to Jeddah are taught about the United States, the history you haven't heard. But first, we turn to Washington. Tom Ridge, Secretary of Homeland Security, gave a surprise press conference today to say that evidence suggests that al-Qaeda is planning another terrorist attack in the United States, one that may target presidential elections this year.
Credible reporting now indicates that al-Qaeda is moving forward with its plans to carry out a large-scale attack in the United States in an effort to disrupt our democratic process. Now, based on the attack in Madrid, and we've had several conversations about that, as well as recent interdictions in England, in Jordan, and Italy, we know that they have the capability to succeed, and they also hold the mistaken belief that their attacks will have an impact on America's resolve.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him what new information came out of Tom Ridge's press conference.
Well, I'm not sure there is any new information. I think what the Secretary was saying was that there's a threat, that there's indications that there could be an attack in the United States at or around the conventions, and that we should be vigilant about that. But I'm trying to find out if there is any new information here, and I'm not finding any, and neither are some of the FBI and other counterterrorism people that I've been talking to. It seems like the same warning that's been issued over the past few weeks and months.
And exactly what's the breadth of that warning?
Well, I mean, I think what Ridge is saying is that even though they lack specifics about time, place, or even method of attack, that they are receiving a lot of intelligence about attacks against the United States, particularly against the elections, as a way of sort of swaying the elections like al-Qaeda did or al-Qaeda affiliates did in Madrid, in Spain, in March.
So how do you interpret the timing if there's no new information, just a kind of ongoing flow?
Well, Rich was asked about that this morning, and he just said basically that we wanted to remind the American public that this was happening. He wanted to outline a few measures that are being taken and to sort of remind people that they need to be vigilant about it. But we're not getting any sense at all that there is new information. John Ashcroft issued the same warning in May, and it seemed almost identical to this.
Tom Ridge was specifically asked, in effect, if this was an attempt to draw attention away from the new Kerry Edwards ticket. What did he say to that, and how tightly joined at the hip is Tom Ridge to George Bush and the Bush campaign? Is that conceivable?
Well, you know, we're trying to figure that out. And, I mean, if you listen carefully to what Ridge said, he said we're laying out for the American public the kind of information we're receiving. But, again, it's nothing new. So it does make you wonder why they're doing it today. You know, there is the announcement yesterday about Kerry and his vice presidential running mate. There's the announcement tomorrow about the CIA and its failures in intelligence. There's a whole bunch of different things that it could be tied to or it could not be. We haven't really gotten a clear answer as to exactly why today was picked as the day to do this.
Tom Ridge was asked if there was a specific threat to the sites of the political party conventions coming up this summer in Boston and New York. What did he have to say there?
Well, he said there wasn't. I mean, that they don't know what's going to happen. This information is not specific to any time, place, or even method of attack. Like somebody from the FBI said to me today when I asked him about what he thought of what Ridge said, he said this is exactly what we said when we had our press conference weeks ago. He said that it's merely an extrapolation of all the available general intelligence, that is something that could happen, but that there's no specificity to the threat, but that they're concerned and they're on the lookout for something that could be going on.
Last week, Josh, the FBI came out citing a number of possible infrastructure targets that could be hit: gas refineries, pipelines, subways, trains,
right.
Nuclear power plants, financial institutions. Are there new measures continuing to be ramped up to protect these kind of facilities or not?
Well, those are the targets that have been identified since almost right after 9/11.
Right.
If they're portraying that as something new, I would be very skeptical of that. I'm not sure they are. And they have been saying since 9/11 that there are new procedures that are being put in place and new measures that are underway. But again, I mean, they keep saying that they're on more heightened alert and that there's more measures in place. It makes you wonder whether that's the case. And if so, I mean, you know, how they can keep amping up what they said was already amped up to the max before. So there is a lot of skepticism here today about exactly what's going on and why the timing of it and what really the threat is.
Josh, what's the break on
a terror threat that one can only imagine could well be real, though who knows, being politically manipulated as we get closer and closer to the election. Is there any break on the potential for manipulation? Is there any way this is not going to be an issue as we get closer to the election, that charges won't be flying of manipulation?
Well, I think John Kerry has already said that that is an issue, and even Michael Moore in his movie Fahrenheit 9/11, there's a sort of rather almost comical segment there about the manipulation and the sort of the constant warnings and the threats and the, you know, the raising of the terror alert and so on. I'm not saying that that's accurate or not, but Kerry certainly has raised the issue, and so have the Democrats, that it is politically timed and politically motivated.
And yet Spain showed that terrorism can also be politically timed and motivated and high impact.
Right, right. And in fact, after that, bin Laden did issue one of his, you know, taped decrees, and he did say that he wants to see more of that, and that it has a very powerful influence, and that he thought that it was a good thing to do. There is a lot of speculation in Washington right now as to whether, if al-Qaeda was trying to attack the United States and they were trying to attack the Bush administration or the convention, whether they would be doing that to get him out of office or to keep him in office. And there's sort of people that believe either one of those would be a legitimate reason for them to want to attack us.
Well, it's going to be a real challenge to American journalists and American voters to keep peering through all this fog. Josh, we thank you for helping us do it.
You're welcome, Tom.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. Think back to your American history lessons at school. Maybe you remember learning about Columbus landing in 1492, Abraham Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address, Lewis and Clark mapping the continent. But do you remember reading about the Franco-American victory at Yorktown in 1781? That's a moment in the American Revolution, in American history, as taught in French schools. And it's just one view of many that children from Beijing to Bahrain are learning about American history. School kids around the world are learning U.S. history, and they're learning it well, but it may not be the history you learned, and they may not see the United States as you see it. Tonight on Point, How the World Learns U.S. History and America Through the International Looking Glass. What can we learn from U.S. history as taught in Zimbabwe, in Shanghai, in Islamabad? Is it any surprise that Mexico would have a different telling of California and Texas history of U.S. history? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Dana Lindemann, doctoral candidate at Harvard University, focusing on how French identity is formed in secondary school books. Good evening. It's great to have you, Dana Lindemann.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
And with us from Terre Haute, Indiana, is Kyle Ward, professor of history and political science at Vincennes University. Good evening and welcome, Kyle Ward.
Good evening, Tom.
Together, you two have co-authored the new book, History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. Dana Lindemann, remind me how you got into this. What led you to focus on this question?
Well, this is a project that Kyle and I have been working on for the last 4 years. 4 years ago, we were teaching it in the International School of Minnesota. It's a private school in Minnesota that has students from over 40 different countries. And in some of Kyle's classes, in his history courses, they were going through certain things in the history textbooks, and students were objecting to the way things were presented in these textbooks, saying, well, that's not the way I learned it in Egypt, or that's not the way I learned it in Colombia. And so Kyle and I began to have some discussions, and I was explaining to Kyle how different things are perceived differently in France, for example, about the end of the 19th century or World War I. And so we started asking ourselves, so I wonder what students in other countries are actually learning about U.S. history, where their national history has crossed with U.S. history. And we had we went online, figured something like this must exist already, found that nothing existed, and so we decided to do some research. And for a couple of years, we went to a textbook library in Germany, where we came across, you know, thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of textbooks from the last century that we were able to delve into and excerpt. Take excerpts and put together a sort of synthesis or a collection of excerpts that we could offer to students to show them different perspectives on these things that their textbooks were teaching them.
And out of that, Kyle Ward, you and Dana came up with a kind of annotated anthology that thematically looks at different periods and issues in American history through the perspective of textbooks written where and during what period?
Well, mostly what we tried to do is keep everything since what we consider the end of the Cold War, 1989. We tried to keep things as updated as much as we possibly could, but we kind of ran into a lot of problems. Even going over to the Eckert Institute in Braunschweig, Germany, Dana said they had tens of thousands of textbooks, but a heavy emphasis on European textbooks. So a lot of the things from Asian, South America, Africa, Middle Eastern textbooks, we had to go elsewhere to try to find this. But we tried to keep it as current as we possibly could.
And what period, Kyle, of American history or what big issues have you looked at through the eyes of those textbooks?
Basically, what we tried to do, the very first thought we had is, as you, Dana, mentioned earlier, we had talked about the different visions that students had on this thing, on these different things. So we thought we'd come up with a supplemental textbook in which we kind of mimicked U.S. history textbooks, going right back to the very beginning of the original exploration and discovery of, if you will, of the New World up until the modern time.
So, Dana Lindemann, begin to take us into this through whatever national perspective you like. Start to give us a sense of how American history is seen by school children and teachers abroad and by adults who have learned from these textbooks.
One example I can give you is North Korea. North Korea is actually one of the more entertaining. They're entertaining and they're very educational. North Korea happens to be both. Some of the language that the North Korean text uses is clearly ideological and full of all sorts of innuendo, language that you would not see in a U.S. history textbook.
Well, they flat out call Americans bastards in the history text that you cite.
Exactly. And one of the things that we like to explain to students or to readers is that in any text that they read, they can look for a certain ideology that sort of is the underpinning of any text. And if you read the North Korean text, simply the use of the word of a word like bastard implies something about the culture or the ideology. Bastard, for example, implies a lack of pure breed, impurity of breed or of race, for example.
And as opposed to the pure Koreans.
Exactly. And for them, they are the only pure Koreans. And they are the last holdout on the peninsula resisting this American imperialism. And in reading this and in reading some of the other excerpts besides the Korean War, that we talk, for example, about the arms agreement in 1993 with Clinton and Carter.
This is North Korea, Clinton, Carter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. When you read this and you read the way that they talk about it, resisting the Americans, wrestling an agreement from the Americans, the powerful imperialists, you get a sense of current politics and an explanation behind the ideology of why they're so resistant to current negotiations.
Now, we would expect North Korea to be one of the most extreme examples here. And even going back to the Korean War, you quote the Korean textbook saying, talking about American forces, writing, "The bastards who crossed the 38th parallel at dawn were stoking the flames of war, jumping around like madmen, yearning to invade the North under any pretext." But this is language we're kind of accustomed to from the North. And yet, when you come up to this 1993 agreement, I was very struck at how this is right in the textbook, and as you say, it's presented as a great victory for them. They dropped a bombshell on the West, and they won in their view.
Absolutely, it's a sort of a rewriting of history. If you go back to the Korean text, they talk about a certain battle called Heartbreak Ridge, and if you look in certain American accounts of this of the war, there is a Heartbreak Ridge, and it's named for the losses that occurred there.
This is Heartbreak Ridge is named by American or Korean forces?
It's an American name. It's, mm-hmm. Americans gave it to the plateau. But the Koreans acknowledge this title and give a whole different explanation of see how the Americans lost here, see how it was a huge cost. And in the end, it's used to sort of propagate their ideology behind their victory. And if you read any other account, they lost.
Kyle Ward, we're going to come back and look at a lot of details of how this history is taught abroad. But overall, we just got half a minute before the break. But do you see an unrecognizable United States as portrayed here, or something that's just at the edges, a different view?
I think that just kind of goes back to what the book is about, with the different perspectives and how people view the U.S. and the U.S.'s role in international relations or when they've had contact with each of these countries.
And it's a view that sometimes is familiar and sometimes very unfamiliar. We'll look at a lot more of it. We're talking tonight about how the rest of the world learns U.S. history, America through the international looking glass. What can we learn from U.S. history as taught in Nigeria, in Manila, in Pyongyang? Who's got it right, them or us or anybody? And is there agreement even on the basic facts of what America means, where it came from? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about how the rest of the world learns U.S. history about America through the international looking glass. My guests, Dana Lindemann and Kyle Ward, are co-authors of the new book, History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. You can join our conversation tonight. Is it any surprise that Mexico, for example, would have a different telling of California and Texas history? And whose history sounds more accurate as you listen to the examples we're going to hear? Whose sounds more honest? Or is everyone's history loaded with some kind of agenda? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dana and Kyle, I hope you'll just shower us with examples for a while here. I'm looking at one. This is from a Mexican textbook on U.S. Reconstruction after the Civil War. And you quote them saying, "Such was the beginning of terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan, which resorted to all means of intimidation, including murder, in order to discourage the black and Latino minorities from fighting for their rights." The word terrorist there thrown up against Americans in the aftermath of the Civil War, and I guess in the Ku Klux Klan, Dana Lindemann, who could dispute it?
You can dispute it. That's exactly what it is. But this is just an example of offering students a different perspective on themselves. That it's rare that American students are given the opportunity to hold a mirror up to themselves about how other people perceive them. David Brooks, in a recent book, writes about how Americans are sort of the big rhino in the room. If there's a big rhino in the room, you're not going to be reading a book or listening to the radio. Your listeners right now would be looking at the rhino in the room. The United States is that rhino. And unfortunately, what we don't realize is that we are that rhino, and that everybody else is looking at us.
So, Kyle, tell us how they see us. Pile up the examples for us. We want to get a sense of what you found. What are the more interesting examples of how U.S. history is taught abroad that may not line up with what Americans have been taught?
Well, with every single event, what we decided to do was look at, you know, the U.S. and how that other country reacted to it. And so what we kind of discovered is that you can kind of line up all these different countries on a spectrum. You have one extreme of mostly the socialist countries, the North Korea, the Cuba, the Vietnams, and then the rest would kind of fall in line. One example of a smaller twist on things is if you look at the Spanish-American War, the issue of the USS Spain, or USS Maine, in U.S. history textbooks, we say, well, first of all, we blame the Spanish, and then later on we said, well, we've done a lot of research and we know it was an accident.
This, of course, the great explosion in the Havana Harbor that led to the Spanish-American War.
Yep, February of 1898. And you start looking at other textbooks. The Filipinos, a country that we probably consider to be a very good ally of ours.
No, let's hold on with just Cuba for a moment. What did you find in the Cuban textbook about the destruction of the Maine?
Dana, want to take that one?
In the Cuban textbook, they say, for example, that the U.S., after much research, the Spanish did all this research, they didn't do it. So it must have been the Americans that did it to themselves. It's a sort of – there's this conspiracy theory in the Cuban textbook.
So the Cubans say Americans blew up their own ship in order to create a pretext to go to war with Spain and to extend their influence.
Correct.
Well, so when you guys, and particularly you, Kyle, as the historian here, come up against the Cuban textbook and its rendition, do you have an itch to track it down yourself? Do you just let these two things hover there in the air? Is it the historian's responsibility to resolve the contradiction?
Well, I think, and this is one thing that we start hoping, sure hope that this book does, is that it brings debate back into the issue of history, or the topic of history, brings debate and research back in. There's a great one later on, I believe it's in the Cold War, another Cuban text that talks about that the U.S. has been doing biological warfare against Cuba for decades. And as I told Dana the first time I read it, my first reaction is, well, that's just obviously wrong. And you discover real quickly, well, that's by American perspective. I have no research whatsoever.
What kind of biological warfare is being suggested?
They argue in their textbook that we've been killing off animals and plants and other things like that.
Crops.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We've kind of been going after their economy. They don't necessarily, if I remember right, don't necessarily say we've gone after the people, but the economy and trying to destroy them. Through our biological warfare, which is the title of that chapter.
You began to mention the history textbooks from the Philippines, which Americans in mid-20th century, you know, fondly called our little brown brothers.
In U.S. history textbooks, the Philippine-American War, which was an offshoot of the Spanish-American War, is, if lucky, might get a paragraph now, maybe two. But at the point in time,
this is 1899 to 1902 or something like that.
Correct.
In the Philippines, when the U.S.
Correct.
Essentially took the Philippines away from Spain.
Yes. It was our first and, some people argue, our only colony. And again, the Filipinos, in their textbook, make the argument that the U.S. blew up the USS Maine in order to have a pretext to go to war. In most part, their text, and that one statement, they're pretty blatant in saying, look at this. Another situation.
And there's surely much more forthcoming on the amount of death and destruction that went into the U.S. conquest of the Philippines. I think it was something like 250,000 Filipinos who died resisting that U.S. takeover.
Yeah, it's very interesting in the fact that the Filipinos, obviously because of where the war took place and the importance to them, give you the stats, the facts, and the figures that go along with it. Of interest also is something else that's completely wiped out of U.S. history textbooks is the issue of prisoner abuse that took place in the Philippines. Filipinos say that when their soldiers were captured by American citizens, American soldiers, there was a lot of torture going on.
We read about the Bataan Death March in the Philippines, not about Americans abusing Filipinos.
Right, exactly. And, you know, jumping ahead to World War II and the Bataan Death March, another thing that kind of disappeared from American history textbooks, but again, something that the Filipinos really want to spend a lot of time on, talking about the atrocities that were committed by the Japanese against the Americans and the Filipinos.
So here in the Philippines, for example, you've got a country that has a real grievance. They were, and U.S. textbooks say it straight out, they were colonized. This was the Americans' overt imperial, declared imperial expansion. What about countries that have historically been closer to the United States? France, the U.K., Canada. What kind of distinctions show up there, Dana?
Canada is a really good example of a longtime ally of the United States in which we found some things that really surprised us. If you look at, for example, the Civil War, you learn that Canada became unified as a country, as a confederation, following the Civil War, 1867, as a result of the U.S. Civil War. In reading their text, it says, because we were afraid of being invaded yet again. And as an American reading this text, you're saying, yet again, when did U.S. ever invade Canada? And they considered the Revolutionary War the first invasion and the War of 1812 the second invasion. Even though Canada doesn't really exist as a country at that time, there's still the British colonies that were invaded by the American colonists and then again by the U.S. Country.
And there was even an extension, a suggestion in the Canadian text, as I note, that they sided, some Canadians, with the South because they feared it would be the North that would invade Canada if it defeated the South.
Exactly.
So I've got a passage here. The South that also had its supporters, that is, Canadian supporters, or in British North America, not necessarily because colonists agreed with slavery, but because some of them feared that a victorious North, that is, United States Union, might unleash its army on Canada, that fear of invasion.
Exactly. And it's not something that you would even consider in the U.S. history classroom today, that the U.S. poses any sort of threat to Canada. But you sort of see it in the at a cultural level nowadays, where there's not the threat of U.S. invasion, but there's this weight of U.S. Culture that exists, and this sort of anecdotal sort of we don't want to become the 51st state kind of thing.
Also, the celebration in Canadian history is of the creation of NATO as a counterweight to American dominance.
Mm-hmm. Much of the Canadian texts are either saying we tried to warn the Americans against this or that act, or we were cleaning up after them in Korea, in Vietnam, wherever they go.
Our neighbors across the border. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them as well. We'll hear more examples, but let's turn first to David calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello, yes. My father grew up in Mexico.
In Mexico, okay.
When we lived in Texas, we came home from school to tell what we knew about the Alamo. He said that he remembered it as a glorious victory for the Mexicans.
The Alamo.
Yes, that's the way he learned it in Mexico. I just wanted to say that...
Of course, it goes down as not exactly a glorious victory for Americans either, but it's cherished even so in Texas history.
Right, so, no, that was meant to be amusing. Sound
right.
Like
right.
No, I think, you know, as do everyone in the world, Americans have both political and psychological motives for viewing the myth of America the good as always behaving well, behaving rightly, doing things in the world with right motives. You know, we all have the need to defend our self-image.
Right.
And but it's that intrinsically means we must suspect our view of ourselves.
I guess that's true wherever you stand, but you're giving us the view from across the border, your father's view from Mexico, and David, thanks for calling that in. Cal Ward, what about it? The examples we've heard so far are kind of poking the U.S. in the eye, and our caller David says You know, the United States may be caught up in some of its myths about its own history, but part of what I took away from your book is that every country is involved in myths about its own history. Do you have a sense of whether the United States is more susceptible to buying the mythology than other nations or not?
Well, I think that we discovered that all textbooks in all nations portray their own national story. And this is, people have to keep in mind that what they're looking at, what they're reading, are history textbooks. Some of the language that Dana read from the North Korean textbooks were actually for junior high kids, 6th, 7th, 8th graders. So there's a story that we want to pass on to the next generation to tell them who they are and where they want their country to be going in the long run.
And every country has that kind of story.
Absolutely. Every country has this sort of bias. And there's two things you can do with bias, though. One is you can ignore it. You can choose to ignore it and put on the blinders, and you end up with sort of restricted vision, which leads to ignorance. Or you can acknowledge it, consider a perspective, and it leads to awareness and better understanding. And that's what we're hoping in this thing. We're providing other perspectives, but we're admitting our own bias.
Take us back to the U.S. Revolution, the kind of touchstone here. And I know you've got things on Columbus before that, but Dana, what about British and French views of the American Revolution and how they might differ from the American telling? And by the way, listeners, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Dana?
Well, the French selection that you heard about earlier, where they considered Yorktown the... It was Yorktown you mentioned, the Franco-American...
Oh, it's the Franco-American victory at Yorktown.
Franco-American victory. There's also certain visual images that they use in the textbooks that talk about, that show the Americans lined up on one side and the colonists and the French lined up on the other and the defeated British marching between them. That's sort of this is the Franco-American alliance that we're talking about.
Is that fiction? Did that happen?
Well... art representation at that time.
I mean, I do remember history storybooks from my childhood that had images just along that line of French soldiers, American soldiers.
Typically, what we see
Redcoats.
In the American textbook is one without the French soldiers.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm.
What they show is the one with the French soldiers. But one of the things that they're more interested in about this period are the ideas. So they talk about the American Revolution as being the sort of this the end of absolutism, this first shot fired, and then they talk about the ideas behind it. And they say, well, the ideas that supported, that came to fruition here were the ideas that were being bandied about in the French salon of the time.
So they're the seedbed. Quoting here from a French textbook, a simple note, revolt by the British colonies of North America against the taxes imposed by the homeland became a veritable political revolution, and they're giving the credit for that to their own political philosophical luminaries back in France.
Exactly. They're the inspiration.
Now, as far as the British looking at that revolution, I was struck by one textbook that questions whether it's even properly called a revolution that created the United States.
Right. The British tend to look at it as more of it's a distraction across the way. It's a rebellion, this sort of thing. Was it a properly revolution? Not really. Some are willing to use the word revolution. The Canadians, however, call it a civil war, which we found very interesting. It's a civil war between British colonists, some loyal to the crown, others against the crown.
And they still use that language today?
Certain textbooks do.
That's amazing. The British textbook you quote here saying this kind of down-the-nose thing, the American colonists were very proud of the way they arranged their government and laws. They were meant to be ruled by Britain, but the journey across the Atlantic took so long that the colonies were allowed to run most of their own affairs, and too bad, they got sick of it. They also note that they say the British took Canada from the French in the Seven Years' War. This had important effects on the 13 colonies. They no longer needed British help to defend themselves from the French attack. And they write, the war had cost the British government a great deal of money. It thought that American colonists should help to pay for it.
The ingrates.
It all sounds very reasonable from the perspective in London, Kyle Ward.
Well, I think the interesting thing about this kind of textbook, too, is first of all, you have to understand that these are written in a modern sense. And international relations, I think, play a certain role in a lot of these things. And there's little minutia that in some of these texts where they talk about the Wool Act as being a major reason for this war. We talk about the Stamp Act as being a major reason. When it comes to the fighting, the British like to point out that, it was mostly our mistakes, the British mistakes, that led to the American victory. The Americans never really did anything to help win this war. And also, I think, because of the relationship that the U.S. and England has had for a few years, there's a few pokes in the eye at things like that, and a lot of people have commented on the one British textbook that points out that Thomas Paine, the author of Common Sense, used to sell women's undergarments before he went to the United States.
So he's hailed as a great and fierce political philosopher in the United States and as a panty salesman.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Look who the Americans look up to.
Right. It's funny how these things read differently when it's in someone else's textbook. You've got a British writer describing the army with which Washington vainly tried to defend Philadelphia in 1777 as, quote, ragged, lousy, naked regiments. American textbooks quote that thing, Dana Lindemann, that sort of thing with pride. This is the kind of Valley Forge, they made it through, they ate moss and survived.
Absolutely. This is one of the things that we talk about, our national stories, our national histories, and the bias that we have. Of course we want to build ourselves up and build up our own history. If you take the example of Cuba, the American textbooks talk about Cuba as you go in and there's, you know, the revolutionary regime that's there. Cubans talk about it as the revolutionary heroes, and the Americans that come down are the American mercenaries, and they're the patriots that fight against the American mercenaries. In American textbooks, they're the rebels. They're the Cuban revolutionaries.
But, of course, Lisa is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I discovered a series of comic books put out by the Sandinista National Liberation Front depicting
Nicaraguan
history for children. And Uncle Sam is depicted as having fangs and claws dripping blood.
Oh, and this is does it look like something that would be used to teach history in a classroom, Lisa?
Well, it was put out by the government, and you know, I assume that it was aimed at children because it's in comic book format.
Do you have a year for that? A publication year?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a publication year for that? Those comic books?
I don't off the top of my head, but I scanned pages of it onto my website, and if you type in We Know Sandino, which is the title of one of them.
And there you get it. Lisa, we're coming up to the break, but let us take that. Dana, what about it? I mean, here was U.S. intervention, some clandestine. It was bloody. Do you find the kind of depiction of American history a straight ratio between American intervention and how damning the depiction is?
This is one thing where you would expect to see something like that in a Nicaraguan text, and the Nicaraguan text that we have in the book doesn't show that. It's strangely absent. They put more emphasis on the economic impact of the U.S. embargo in their harbor as opposed to the direct involvement or the subversive involvement.
Maybe that's depends on exactly when the textbook was written.
Exactly.
Maybe they're trying to patch up relations
Absolutely.
With Washington by the time that was put together.
Yeah, but one of the things they do have is a longer view of history where they talk about Sandino earlier, who becomes the Sandinistas, mm-hmm. whereas the U.S. doesn't talk about that. There's not the U.S. involvement at the beginning and where it leads.
We're talking tonight about how the rest of the world views U.S. history. I'm joined by Dana Lindemann and Kyle Ward, co-authors of the new book, History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. You can join our conversation tonight. Are these histories from abroad harsher or more generous toward the U.S. than you expected? Is their history libelous or is ours whitewashed? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about how the rest of the world learns U.S. history, about America through the international looking glass. I'm joined tonight by the co-authors of a new book, History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. With me in the studio, Dana Lindemann, a Ph.D. candidate at Harvard University. And with us from Terre Haute, Indiana, professor of history and political science at Vincennes University, Kyle Ward. You can join the conversation as well. Could a history be written that did not have a national bias? And does history, once learned, color our views for life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Geraldo's calling. Hi, Geraldo. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I thought I'd add my 2 cents into the conversation.
Let's hear it.
I grew up in Mexico.
Yeah.
I went to elementary school and high school in Mexico and then did my college work here. So I had the opportunity to view American history from 2 different points of view.
How different were they, Geraldo?
Well, they are different, but let me just say that there's 3 points that I think are relevant here.
Okay.
And one is parochialism.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is self-interest. And the third one is provocation. Parochialism, in the sense that American history, as taught in the United States, tends to be extremely parochial. It focuses only on the American point of view and no other. The history that I I learned in Mexico covered, of course, the history of Mexico, the history of the United States, but also international history, and in particular the history of China,
mm-hmm.
of Europe, of Russia. So we got a lot of different points of views there.
And self-interest. I guess everyone has an element of self-interest tinging their view of history, but did you find it different between the U.S. and Mexico?
Well, self-interest in the sense that America's intervention in other countries has tended to be for its own self-interest, but always portrayed as in the interest of the country in which we are intervening.
And how's that different from your third point, provocation?
Well, the provocation in the sense that Americans feel that it is absolutely necessary to feel justified to engage in a war, so they always begin a provocation to force the other side to attack and use that as an excuse to then intervene. Such was the case in the Mexican-American War, which in Mexico is called the North American Invasion.
Yeah.
We're talking here about Zachary Taylor and his dragoons moving down to the Rio Grande Valley and raising the flag across the Rio Grande from Matamoros to provoke the Mexican troops there. They were in disputed territory, and then when the Mexican army attacked, then they used that as an excuse and proceeded to invade Mexico.
And so history unfolds and gets taught differently even unto this day. Geraldo, thanks for your call. Kyle Ward, I keep coming back to this, but I do wonder about the level of accuracy, as far as you could judge it, between what you saw in textbooks abroad. I know there's a wide range, and what you see in history textbooks in the United States. Are you comfortable talking about levels of accuracy? Who's got it more correct? Who's got it more bent by parochialism, self-interest, whatever motive?
With the exception, and that's my own personal view, but with the exception of some of the extreme cases, like a North Korea, for the most part, no, I don't think you can really come out and say that one a textbook can be written that is unbiased. That's just, I think, humanly impossible. And you can't come out and say one group is correct over another. You have to understand each other's history, each other's culture, and your own background to get a real good understanding of where and why people believe the things they do.
Dana Lindemann, we've got to talk about the Middle Eastern issue, because there you get another very shocking sometimes view of American history. And we've heard a lot about this since 9/11, but when you read the textbook, it's very clear, just point by point, what's the tenor of U.S. history as taught in Saudi Arabia, let's say?
U.S. history as taught in Saudi Arabia is rather provocative in the sense that they see the U.S. as responsible for a number of the ills, or the West in general as a number of the ills that go on there. Some of the terminology that they use are things like crusaders, the westernizers, the Christianizers, Zionism, this sort of thing, which is all in a very negative connotation. But it gives an example of a very sort of long sense of history in their minds, where they're referring to the West as crusaders. Well, the Crusades happened long before the U.S. was even a country, or even thought of, or even had been between the context of the Old and New Worlds. But it still registers as part of the American identity to them.
And here I'm looking at a kind of litany of complaints lumped in under imperialism, but with the United States clearly included there, saying how the effect has been to tear Islamic unity to pieces, to spread harmful social habits which are forbidden by Islamic law, drugs, alcohol, games of chance, wicked entertainments. What else? It just goes right on. Emptying education of its Islamic content and giving it a secular direction, keeping Muslims in ignorance of one another. Long bill of complaints against the United
Absolutely.
States.
Absolutely. But one of the really interesting things about that text right there, and one of the things that students or readers discover in reading a list like this, is what we're talking about is an ideology of extreme fundamentalism here. And if you replace the word Muslim with the word Christian in these examples, you have language that sounds vaguely familiar in other discussions, other countries of religious fundamentalism, where they're talking about taking Christianity out of the classroom. And there's...
So you're talking about American textbooks, am I hearing you right?
Not in American textbooks, but the same sort of language is used in some of this debate about American textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
Between the left and the right. Right now, it's the right that controls, the extreme fundamentalists that control the textbooks in Saudi Arabia, for example. And they're trying to rewrite them per the princes of Saudi Arabia.
But they have a pretty strong influence in some American states as well, big states where these issues get settled.
You're talking about the...
Well, I mean, for example, does the word evolution get used in textbooks? And I don't know on the history front. I haven't looked at that as closely. But, I mean, it's not only abroad that history textbooks get a kind of political vetting before they hit the schools.
Oh, absolutely not. It's here from A to Z. It's political. But the one thing that's different about the United States, the exception that it has, is that it is not, there's no national standards for history. Whereas in other countries, Korea being the extreme example, or Cuba, or South Korea even, it's the state that not only writes the curriculum but publishes the textbook, and there's one. Everybody uses the same textbook. Most other countries, the nation sets the curriculum, and publishing houses have to publish toward that curriculum.
The other thing I'd like to jump in here real quick,
yes,
say, too, is that with U.S. textbooks, because, like you were saying, Tom, because of it being market-driven and the need for a history textbook for a high school to be picked up in Texas, North Carolina, Florida, or California that has these kind of requirements, what's unfortunately happened to a lot of American history textbooks is they've turned into very large and very bland encyclopedic type of things, in which they've taken out all the bias, all the perceptions, interpretation, things like that.
Is taking bias out a problem?
Well, I think if you want to start talking about teaching of history, I would much rather have somebody come in and say, here's my opinion, here's where we stand on this issue, and you can agree or disagree. And what U.S. history textbooks have kind of done is just kind of give the nuts and bolts of it. And I think you talk to a lot of high school history students or people who have had history classes, and they're bored with it. They don't want to learn dates and facts anymore.
So bring back a little attitude, but remember, you won't be the only ones with attitude. Every country has its own, and about American history in particular. It's been a fascinating quick tour around the world on the history front. Kyle Ward and Tara Hote, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And Dana Lindemann, right with me here in the Boston studios. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Dana Lindemann and Kyle Ward, author of the new History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, former Enron CEO Ken Lay turns himself in. This is On Point. Former Enron CEO Kenneth Lay was led in handcuffs into a federal courthouse in Houston today, where he pled not guilty to 11 counts of fraud related to the collapse of the energy giant. The charges were contained in a 65-page indictment that was unsealed this morning. Lay was later released on a $500,000 bond. It was a rough day for Ken Lay, as the Securities and Exchange Commission also filed civil charges against him seeking more than $90 million from what it called illegal stock sales. After his appearance in the Houston courtroom, Lay held a press conference to defend himself.
Enron's filing for bankruptcy protection on December 2, 2001... was clearly one of the saddest, if not the saddest, day of my life, both personally and professionally, and caused enormous and irreversible hardship for thousands of good Enron employees and retirees, as well as many others. The Enron collapse was an enormous tragedy. I continue to grieve, as does my family, over the loss of the company, my failure to be able to save it, and the tremendous hardship that caused so many employees, retirees, and others. But failure does not equate to a crime. Although my lawyers and I believe I should not have been indicted, now that I have been, I have instructed my legal team that I want a speedy trial, and I hope it will begin by early September this year. Not only are we ready to go to trial, but we are anxious to prove my innocence. I also believe, as chairman and CEO of Enron, when it collapsed, it is my duty and obligation to go to trial as soon as possible.
Former Enron CEO Kenneth Lay speaking earlier today in Houston, Texas. I'm joined now by John Coffey, a law professor at Columbia University who studies white-collar crime. Good evening and welcome, John Coffey.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. They're the voice of a CEO who knows he's in trouble but doesn't exactly sound abashed, John Coffey.
No, he's got a very strong, and it's a somewhat unorthodox defense. Just about every other white-collar defendant hunkers down and is totally quiet and lets only his lawyer talk for him. This was a very dramatic defense on his part, very outspoken. Not only did he tell you his side, he took questions from reporters, and he got pressed on all kinds of issues. This is sort of a model of transparency, but it's very inconsistent with his prior behavior. When he was before the Senate 2 years ago, he took the Fifth Amendment. Now, of course, he's very outspoken. He's shifted his strategy.
Well, what do you make of it? What is the strategy here in coming out guns blazing, talking transparent, as you say,
to a point? I think he believes that down in Houston, where the public opinion is deeply, deeply hostile to Enron and all of its senior management, where there's been a great deal of pain and economic loss, he's got to fight this case in the court of public opinion and tell his story. And essentially his story is that Mr. Fasto, the chief financial officer, is the villain who betrayed everyone else, and he is, in his view, the hero. He had retired, left Enron, was going to join a big New York investment banking firm, and he came back to save the day once Mr. Skilling suddenly resigned and threw the company in turmoil, and he was there only for 6 weeks before the company totally collapsed and went into bankruptcy in December. So he's going to say, I came back to be a hero. I'm sorry I didn't succeed, but the government's indicting me as a scapegoat.
I was hoodwinked.
But that's why he wants to be very public about it.
But, of course, denying guilt doesn't mean big business guys get off. Just today we saw Adelphia Communications Corp. founder John Regas found guilty.
There's no question that that was a classic fraud trial. I would distinguish the charges against Ken Lay, which are extremely narrow and focus on his behavior only during about 5 or 6 weeks. They don't charge insider trading as a criminal charge against him or anything during his earlier administration of Enron. They only start with September and go through the end of October with him. And that's a very tight, narrow focus. And he's going to respond that, look, I'm not responsible for this. Other people lied to me. This is going to be a very contested trial.
How do you interpret that narrow focus? Does that suggest that the prosecution is not so confident of its case?
They charged very broad misconduct against Skilling and Causey. They charged them of guilty of a 2 or 3 year conspiracy to cook the books. They didn't bring those charges against Mr. Lay, I think because they felt he was kind of a remote, distant, hands-off CEO who didn't know all these details. Now when they come to the 5 or 6 weeks when he's in control, they're going to have an issue about whether he really understood the accounting. They're going to need some witness, and I don't think it will be Ken Fasto, because he had already resigned by that point, who can say Mr. Lay understood that we had much more serious problems than he was disclosing.
And in the half minute we've got left, can Ken Lay make headway just by appealing to public opinion? How influential can that be?
Well, you know, I can't tell you that the odds are in his side. You heard him talking about an early trial, and I think what he's really doing there is trying to set the groundwork for asking for a severance. His greatest tactical problem is he's being tried with Skilling and Causey, against whom there's much more evidence over a much longer period.
And he wants to get away from them, and we understand that point. John Coffey, we're out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us tonight. Great to have you. John Coffey, law professor at Columbia University. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.